I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, everybody. We're coming to you live from the London Review Bookshop with a guest who has established himself really over the past decade as one of the world's leading novelists. And surprisingly, he's done that without having to go to the effort of making things up, because he's a master of what's called autofiction, mining the incidents of his own life, both tragic and sometimes comically embarrassing, for his great six-volume novel, My Struggle. Now, though, nearly 10 years after he finished My Struggle, he's publishing another novel, and this time it's pure fiction, as you'll be relieved to hear when you hear about some of the horrible and creepy and strange goings-on that happen in it. It's been described as a move into Stephen King territory, but it's also very recognisably a Knausgård book. It's long, gripping, and it has an insight into the way the human mind works that makes you feel the author has been spying on your inmost thoughts. The book is called The Morning Star, and the author is Karl Ove Knausgård. Welcome, Karl Ove.
Thank you.
And we're going to start off by having you read a little bit from your new book.
Yeah, it's called The Morning Star, and I'm going to read the part where the morning star appears for the very first time in the book. The road led on through an area of forest, the trees standing darkly on either side. In the daytime, you could sometimes glimpse the sea between their trunks, and it was always hard to tell if the rushing sound you could hear came from the trees or the waves running against the shore further down. I lowered the window and tossed my cigarette out, lit another, and took a swig of whiskey. I put the bottle in the drink holder and couldn't believe I hadn't thought of it before. It was secure there, even without the top on. There was a bend in the road, after which I emerged onto the outstretched plain that made you think you were somewhere up in the high fells. Suddenly, there was a crunching noise from under the wheels. It sounded like a series of small explosions. I slammed on the brakes. Was it a flat tire? No. There was something on the road. All over the road. They looked like pebbles, but they were moving. I opened the door and got out cautiously. And then I saw that they were crabs. Crabs in their hundreds. They made a ticking sound. Bloody hell. What was going on? I went back to the car and got in and shut the door. They kept coming, crawling out onto the road from the grass. I gulped some more whiskey and lit another cigarette. It was like they were answering the call of some other power, as if they were drawn by a light. But on land? Ah, they were stared by instinct, and why shouldn't instinct break down like everything else? I sat for a while, hesitating to turn on the ignition. There was no way I could carry on without running them over. Then, just when I got myself together and put the car into gear to slowly make my way, the sky flared over the ridge at the end of the plain. It looked like the forest was on fire. But it was a heavenly body, I realized, for the light ascended into the sky, separating itself from the ridge in moments. It was a star. And what a star. I killed the engine and got out, leaned back against the car and gazed up at it. Behind me, on the passenger seat, the phone lit up again.
Thank you so much. It's just, yeah, the shivers going down my back. It's really almost like something from a horror film. And that's just the start of the strange happenings that are going to occur in this book. But I thought we'd start talk about your return to pure fiction, because you started your career writing, I guess you call them fictional novels, Out of the World and A Time for Everything. And then you really left pure fiction behind for a long time. I think you said you had a problem with fiction, or you felt fiction was an inadequate way of writing about the world.
Well, not in general, but for me, it was. Mm. And that was the reason I wrote my struggle, really. It felt like everything was kind of turned into fiction and news. That's a fiction. There's a way of narrate something that doesn't correspond to the way I feel and the way I experience things, you know. Like, this is the difference between that kind of thinking and that way of writing and the real life. So what I wanted to do then was, because I was writing about the death of my father, that was what I wanted to write about, and that was this what the book is about. And I tried as a novel, didn't work, and then I just throw all of that overboard and try to write as directly as I could about what I knew. But that doesn't mean, through that period I read fiction, love fiction. It's not that, it's the way, it's not like the novel, because the novel can do all kind of things, you know. It's more like the feeling that everything is become a story, you know. And if you are in that story, there's no way to recognize the way it's described. It feels completely different.
So it's kind of like the narratives that the media follows. And Morning Star is your first major novel, major work, really, since the end of my struggle. So it's probably about 9 or 10 years between the two. So did you deliberately decide you weren't going to work on a huge project for a long time, or did it just happen that way?
Did just happen. I mean, I wrote every day. I've written every day since my struggle and published, maybe published 10 or 12 books or something in that time, but all kind of minor things and essays and works about artists and stuff. And there was no desire to write a novel, but I had it in mind, and I've been thinking a lot, been reading a lot, and kind of just one day, people I had to start, and I started, and then that's the novel. So,
and yes, but as you say, those minor works, you call them, or shorter works over the past decade, essays, the book about football, which I greatly enjoyed, and the Seasons books. Again, there's a lot of writing about yourself in those, some writing about your family. So with this book, does it feel very different to go back to total fiction?
Not really. It feels like, to me, writing is writing. Mm-hmm. So even if writing letters has a kind of that value to me as the act of writing, not reading it, but the act of writing. So I think more I write. And I write books and you know, different kind of things. And it's like it goes, the years go by, and it comes this and that. And then I end up here in this book. And it's not really different to write. But of course, the what I'm looking for is completely different in this book. And I try to use fiction and the tools of fiction to get somewhere, to understand something. So in this book, it's kind of important. The one thing I thought before I started it was that it should be many narrators, should be in many persons, many people, and many people's life, like a choir of those people. Because that is basically the opposite of what my struggle is, which is the world in one person. And this is like many worlds. And then the tension, some of the tension is what's going on between those worlds. And there is also a sense of that each person has restrictions, has limited knowledge, and they all are part of the same world. They all see the same morning star and they all think about that, but in very different ways. And I think that's how life is, and that's how we are. But that was very much what I aimed to do in this book.
So, yes, we have, I think I counted 9 characters we hear from the viewpoint of. There's many characters in the book, but some of the people you're writing as, there's a literature professor, there's a priest, a woman priest, a journalist, a nurse, there's a nursery school worker. So, you know, you're wanting to get into as many people as possible.
At least there should be a kind of a variation between their, you know, experiences and insights. So there is a difference in ages and sexes, yeah, and also what they're doing, their occupation. But yeah, and I didn't kind of, you know, pick them deliberately. It was just something that turned up one by one when, yeah, I was writing. So it's a kind of a, it's not like a blockbuster movement from A to B, yeah, to C, and this is like, yeah, very much different, yeah, kind of paths and patterns and things going on in it.
And was it difficult to get into the heads of some of the characters who are obviously totally unlike you, which is not what you were doing in My Struggle?
Yeah, it was very difficult. I started with a woman, mm-hmm, character, and that I think I struggled with writing that for months, really, if not more. Mm. And the problem was that since it wasn't me and since it was a woman, I felt like it was a lot of things I wasn't allowed to do. I was very afraid of doing mistakes, you know. And if you're afraid of doing mistakes, then the writing isn't very good. It becomes very stiff and dead almost. So I needed to get rid of those restrictions and try to just write, and not think this is a woman in any way or that she's very different from me, but just go in there. And so what you do, or what I did, is to you draw on your own kind of emotions and feelings. And for instance, there's one young girl, she's in her early 20s, she's like 21, she works at the supermarket. She is very brilliant, but she is also incredibly shy and have difficulty with being with other people. So she was studying, couldn't do it, couldn't face it. So she went to that job, and the way I dealt, and she's very lonely. So the way I dealt with that is, of course, I put in all my own experience of loneliness, yes, when, yeah, I was 16, and I don't think that's very different from being a girl or a boy at that age. Is the same. You are very vulnerable and you are, you know, exposed somehow to where you are and who your parents are. And I just draw on that. And it is basically the same with all of the characters. Mm. So it's not in any way self-biographical, but still, you know, it comes from somewhere, the emotions mostly, or the feelings or whatever.
And his character is so different from you. Although the first chapter, Arne is the character. He's a literature professor, and he does ring some familiar bells, because he has this preoccupation with mundane details, which is, yeah, familiar from My Struggle, and he worries about looking masculine and his children, and his wife is ill, and that sounds a familiar note, but it's almost like you're playing with us, because suddenly the book becomes very different from what we expect.
Yeah, and I wasn't playing with it, but there are something in that story that I'm interested in. And I knew that, you know, that could be the way people thought about it. Okay, that's him. But exactly, he's departing in ways. So for me, he was never even close to me. Mm-hmm. But then I have now like a language and a way to write about things, and I think I use that more in him than in the others somehow. But what I'm interested in that story is many things. But one of them is, and that's something that goes through all of them, is what is reality, what we see, mm-hmm, how we perceive the world. So you have one person, that's the young girl. She sees a fire, and She kind of gets terrified, it's burning, and then it isn't. And that was something I thought about. I was in Albania, actually, doing a reportage about brain operations, and there was someone there that had a brain tumor that saw things that didn't exist, which is incredibly scary, and it is like it's real, so you just don't know. And it's the same in the state of mind of the wife in the first chapter. She's getting into a psychosis. And when you are psychotic, you see things that doesn't exist. You understand them differently. Yes. And there are many kind of those borderlines in the book between what's here and what we see and what's real and not. In many levels, this is one level and there are other levels. And that interests me a lot.
Yeah.
And it has to do with, you know, with some of what I've always been working on. What's reality? What is it we see? How much can we trust it? Mm. In my struggle, it's obviously that the character doesn't understand everything and do, you know, but you as a reader could see a more whole picture. And this book, it goes kind of even more into that area somehow.
Yeah. And it's, of course, there's this great device, the star, that appears in the sky. So all the characters, some of them know each other and some of them don't, but they're all, the star is there as a sort of fixed point for all of them.
Yeah, exactly.
But at the same time, they're also living their lives. They have their normal problems to deal with. The star, although it's very disturbing to have this new star appear in the sky, it's kind of in the background for all of them.
Yeah, the novel takes place in 2 days and it's like the end of the first day, the star appears. And they all try to make sense of it. They all try to put it into something they already know. Mm. But the thought of the morning star, for me, was to have something in a book that you don't know what is. Mm. That's not established. That's kind of out of the categories. And that's very scary. Mm-hmm. Everything that's out of category is scary. That's why, you know, the horror films are scary, because that's what's happening. And it's the same with other things in the book. It's like the line between life and death becoming blurry. So you're not even sure if the dead is dead, you know, and that's scary to me, to me at least. And so it's entering into those kind of boundaries between established categories, and the Morningstar is kind of, I've never seen anything new in my life that have no explanation.
Yeah.
It's like there's no mystery, there's nothing, because we have an explanation for everything. Mm. And if we don't, there will come one, you know. And it's just very interesting, because the explanations often don't explain anything.
Yeah.
You know, if you go into, for instance, you know, nuclear physics or whatever, it's described, but it doesn't explain it. It's like it's the mystery, it's still there. And I wanted the mystery to be bang, present and in front of all of them somehow. And they deal with it, like put it into something normal, almost with once, all of them.
Yes.
And some of them don't even care about it.
Yes. So all the different attitudes. And I think this is the first, do you think, in a trilogy or... Well, you don't know a series?
I don't know. I never plan.
But you've done a second one.
Yeah, but I realized when I wrote this that it has to be more. So I've written one more. That will be out in Norway at the end of this month, actually. And then it has to be one more because the story isn't done yet. But I don't know where it's taking me. I have really no idea.
And will we know more about the star and what it means as the books go on?
It's the story has just begun but it still is a standalone book. So it has this, and that's the point also, that it will be shaped like a total novel, and then it will kind of depart in different ways.
Yeah, so we'll probably get the next one in about a year. So it's very, very exciting.
I guess so.
One of the themes of the book, I think, it seems to be about the limits of rationalism as a way of describing the world. And one character says, you know, the irrational world, people who believe it, it's confined to its own space, like the children's table at a grown-up party, which is a great way of looking at it. And I'm very aware that the characters are not expressing your opinions, but it, I do get the sense this book is saying there's something almost unhealthy about relentless rationalism that doesn't admit of any other explanation viewing the world.
I don't know about unhealthy, but it's like it's not, it doesn't feel like it's enough.
Right.
It does, it feel like it's just a tiny part of the whole picture. Mm. And we have followed that path, and it's led us into a lot of places where I'm not sure really it's that great to go. So yeah, that's part of the book, but it's also a point of having many different narrators is that it seeks out some sort of complexity, and it's very important that the views are the views in the book. Mm. So there are many views in the book. It's not like I haven't written about my opinions at all, but I am very interested in exactly that. And it goes into many things. It goes into the way we you know, use nature for an own purpose, like on an industrial scale. Use animals on an industrial scale. It's like that's part of our world that we completely accept, and it's in some way it's good, but also but that's kind of the, could you say, the subtext of the book. Yeah. So I don't write directly about anything of this, but I want, because that would be like preaching somehow.
Yeah.
So it's much more interested in opening up, seeking complexity, seeking kind of multi-layered.
Mm.
Yeah. And also the characters, some of them are very simple when it comes to thoughts and thinking and understanding. So it's,
that's interesting what you say about not preaching, and because in the passage you just read with the crabs, it's, and a lot of this happens in the book, it's animals or aspects of nature behaving in a way you don't expect, which makes us think about you know, the environmental crisis at the moment, even if it's not addressing it directly, it seems to be there at the bottom.
Yeah, it definitely is. One of the things I had before I started this book was the sentence that's not in the book, but it was for me, like, we have turned our back to nature. That's kind of, that's where it starts.
And there's also, I think we can say there might be the odd ghost in the book, but I don't see ghosts in this book as being benign or malign. They're just sort of, they're there, aren't they?
Yeah, something have happened between the boundaries between life and death. Mm. Probably, or maybe, I don't know, but connected with the Morning Star. I don't know how much. It's not like it's a plot oriented book. So I can't tell then. But it's there is an essay in the book written by one of the characters, which is about death. What's that death for? Can we imagine a world without death? And I felt when I wrote that it's like death is like an abstract idea, and it isn't. It's very real, and it's very physically, and it's very, very, very horrible, of course. So then I kind of moved the essay into more like his life, and then he takes the train, and then he meets someone on the train, start to talk with him, and then we are in a story which has to do with a real occurrence of death, and that's where the ghost is coming in, and that's a self-biographical story, the first part of it,
right?
Because I did, when I was in my 20s, I took the train from Oslo to Bergen, in a sleeping coach, two beds, so I shared with someone, and he sat down, started to drink. He was my age. He offered me, so took a beer with him, and he started to tell me this incredible stories from his life. Like, he was completely open. But one thing he said, he was a doctor at nowhere to go with helicopters, and he said when they landed, the scene where there was medical urgency. Is that to see? There was always someone who the other didn't see that wasn't there. And he started to think about what that could be. And he was kind of intensely serious. Mm-hmm. It was like, so he had seen those people, they didn't exist, what was that? Were they dead? Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, in a little fjord landing, there's someone there. So I kind of used that story to enter it, and then it kind of explodes almost from there, and then the book ends. It's not that like I believe in ghosts or anything like that, but it was such a powerful story, and I started to imagine what if that was true, what if that's what it was, and so on and so on. So this is a book about crossing those, you know, into
boundaries.
It's
interesting what you say about that last chapter. It starts with an essay, and then you felt the essay was too detached almost from...
No, it's a kind of an intellectual essay in a way, you know, almost an... It's not an academic essay, but it's like that. It's about ideas. It's an essay about ideas and the idea of death. And it goes through the history of how people have understood death and the underworld. And there is a realization in that essay that this is still kind of abstract and still up there. And it's literature, it's not real. And then it kind of goes into real.
And one of the things discussed in that essay is it's not so much whether ghosts exist that's interesting, it's more why do people believe in them, and why do, you know, why does one generation believe in them 200 years ago and now we don't? But if we had lived then, if we were the same people, we would think differently.
Yeah, exactly. I got this book, brilliant book. It's about paintings from of phenomenons that have occurred in history, and it's from like 1400 or something. And the phenomenons are, you know, it's like two suns all of a sudden, or it's like a new star. What's that new star? Like, let's say it was in 1265, there was a new star. Mm-hmm. And they obviously saw it and obviously believed in it. And I thought, what if we see that? What's happened? What's changed? It's the idea that living in 1265, the world is completely different because you believe in completely different things. You have a completely different worldview, so the world is different. And that kind of thought that we somehow construct our own world is also central to this book. Because I put a star from 1265 into her and says it's actually happening. And it was actually happening then.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Yeah.
But we don't know.
And this is a pandemic novel in the sense that you wrote it during the pandemic, didn't you?
Yeah, like two-thirds of it I wrote in lockdown here in London.
And you think that the lockdown, the pandemic, seeped into the book? In a way.
Yeah, it did. I wasn't aware of it, but I could see it clearly afterwards, that there was something with the feeling I had at the beginning, especially at the lockdown, where you had a threat that was outside, and it was a major threat, and we didn't really know what it was. We didn't really know how it would end. And, you know, you saw people with masks, and I've never seen that before, gloves, and you heard ambulance all the time, and it was threatening. And then on the other hand, we had kind of the family life. Everybody has to be indoor, you know, very nice thing. But then the dynamic between threat outside and everybody had the same, you know, everybody had the same experience of what happened outside. It wasn't like I couldn't call anyone and say, you know, what's happening here in London, because it was happening everywhere. Yeah. It wasn't a way out of it. It was like it was everywhere. I never experienced that before. But the kind of logic to that situation is the logic in that book. But that's the only similarity, really, that there is something threatening, unknown, and it's outside. And we don't know how it will affect us. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But that was, that's obviously a part of it.
also at the same time the sense of people are carrying on living their lives and dealing with their emotional crises that they happen to have been in the middle of anyway.
Yeah, and then the sense of what happened in the pandemic was how it didn't take long before it was kind of everyday life normalized in a way, and we lived with it, and we still do, you know.
Yeah.
We're incredibly to adapt to situations, and yeah, that's kind of basic human nature, I think.
And people always ask writers, you know, was it very different for you because you're at home writing anyway, rather than going out to work in an office?
Yeah, but the difference was at the house. Normally I do it and I'm alone in the house, but now the house is filled with people, which was great. It was all kind of things that period, of course.
So you learned, you know, how to work with people all around you?
I know that from before.
Right.
When I started out as a writer, I thought I could only write, you know, in majestic solitude. I traveled to isolated islands and lighthouses I brought in. And I didn't really write well. I mean, I could stay 2 months on an island without being able to write, just because it was all empty, you know. But then I got children. I got used to dealing with all kind of stuff and writing. So the thresholds of writing kind of went drastically down. And that made it much, much better for me to write. Mm. And it's much better to treat writing as something almost like taking the dishes or whatever, but something you do, something you're in. So you're in family life and in normal life, in writing. It's like, so that's very much an experience I had through my struggle.
Right.
That it was kind of, part of the same, not the same process, of course, part of the same life. Mm. It wasn't isolated very much.
Yeah. So just an ordinary part of life.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you've lived in London for a few years now, is that right?
Yeah, I've been here 4 years now.
Yeah. And I think you said you might write something about London soon, or you're contemplating it, is that right?
I am very much thinking about that. But I don't know how long time it will take before it's possible, because when you first experience something, it's takes a while because before it kind of sinks in and you can write about it in a natural way. But I do want to do that. Also because I have all my books has been like, it's Norway, it's Norwegian landscape, it's Norwegian mentality.
Yeah.
So in the next book, it's actually half of it is in Russia. So I try to move out. But then I do really want to write about the feeling of entering a new country. Mm-hmm. All the things that you don't, you know, really understand, and then you start to understand it. And I've always been an Anglophile, you know, because of the music and the football.
Yeah.
So it's I can't say I'm like coming home to move here.
Yeah.
That would be to offend you. You are home, but it feels like a brilliant place to be for me.
Yeah.
Really. And I think of, and especially London with all the layers of history, that's so exciting to try to write about. And one who did that incredibly good was Sebald. His book about the rings of Saturn was walking. That's Norfolk, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's kind of the perfect book about being here, I think. And he was German, and I'm not comparing myself to him at all, but it just when I read him, I want to write, you know, because it's so, there's a depth to it, and it's compelling and interesting always. Yeah, and that shows it is possible to be a foreigner writing about England.
Mm. Well, we all, reading My Struggle, we know you lived in Sweden for a long time.
Yeah.
Do you miss Sweden now, or are you happy to?
And I don't miss Sweden. We have a house there, and I do miss the landscape there and the village we lived in. But I don't miss it because we are there occasionally. I do like it there very much. But it's kind of the opposite of here. Yeah. I mean, yeah, just a village with 200 people and, yeah. and countryside. That's...
And do you think you've finished writing about your own life, you know, in the my struggle way? Is that
that's
you don't think you'll get the urge again?
No, I don't really. One thing is that it is incredibly hard, and another thing is that I've done it, and there would be no point of doing it again. And there's no challenge to it, because also I found a way to do it, and right. and but I can do it. I know I can do it, but it's so much more challenging for me to do this, and to see what happens there.
So you, part of setting out on the book is you're thinking, how can I challenge myself to do something new every time?
Yeah, because it's not necessarily to do something new, but it's when I write, I have to not know. I have to start somewhere where I don't know. And so the book is a way to look for something, to find something, and it's always it's related to meaning somehow. And if I know, then there's no joy, then there's no fun, then there's nothing to discover. So that's also why writing for me is the same, because it is looking for something, you know, in many different ways. But it's like a constant movement somehow.
And I wonder also, because my struggle, much of the territory it covered, you know, it's quite a bad period in your life, or many bad periods. And now, from what I read now and what you've said in interviews, you seem happier and more settled now than you were maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So maybe it wouldn't be as interesting now to, to write.
Yeah, no, that's it's true that writing about happiness or writing about, you know, it's no joy to read. I tried in this book to write about a good person.
Yeah.
That's, you know, good throughout, that doesn't put herself first, but actually the others first. And that was a challenge to try to get alive, just because there is something interesting there, I think. I don't know why it is like that, but it's but I think the best book in that sense is, of course, The Idiot by Dostoevsky, where the good person kind of knocks everything out.
Yes.
And it's the what happens around him that's the book.
Yeah.
Of course you could write about that. I mean, of course, but I don't feel the urge to do it, actually.
That was another theme of my struggle. It was about you wanting to be a good person and taking that seriously, but it's not that easy. So obviously you admire someone who can be good.
Yeah, I do. I think that's, I've always done that, actually. Or people that you know, if you are in a lifeboat, you're coming, and he won't or she won't throw you out.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of person.
Yeah,
it's I do admire good writers and good people, I think.
Yeah,
meaning I'm not either myself.
Yes.
that's the clue.
They don't always cross over, the good people and the good writers. Sometimes, but not always.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
One thing about writing my struggle is that people, they feel they really know you.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you might disagree. They don't know everything about you. But it's, you know, for someone, you're quite a private person, but people feel they have some right to know about your life because of that book.
Yeah. It should be like this, you know. I'm giving myself away in books, and that's it.
Yeah,
but it isn't, because people have always, since this book started to come out, and that was the big change in my writing. It was it was that people, they weren't actually interested in my writing; they were interested in something that related to themselves, and they want to talk about themselves. And that is kind of the greatest gift to any writer, I think. And it isn't like you can Of course you can. I mean, but you can't just shut down, and because if it means something, then it means something. I remember one time abroad doing a reading, and someone's coming over to me, you know, crying, and her brother just died, and wanted to. That's kind of situations I never have been in.
Yeah,
there was a sense of some sort of confidence or some sort of, you know, and what do you do? I don't know, you know, anything of this, but that's through literature, and there is a sense of connection, and so you can't, I can't just say,
yeah,
I don't, can't. Of course, I do that. I'm more, I don't do that much events anymore, and I actually try to stop to talk about my struggle in interviews because I've done it for 10 years. Yeah. But still, it feels like, it's weird. It's not quite just a literary book. It is something more for some people. And then, it feels like it's somehow alive in a way. And that's the best, I think, thing for a book to happen. And it happened for some cases with these books. And so now I'm not bothered by it. I'm not. Yeah. It's not like I think, can't they stop or asking me about that? Or it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think about that book anymore at all myself, but that's what happened. I mean, you have asked a few questions about it already. Yes.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Well, I'm sure our audience it may have had a similar effect on them. And they've sent us a few questions. If you have any more questions out there, please do submit them now. But we've got one here from Katie Zitzko, who says, thank you for an amazing conversation. What an inspiration you are. And she's wondering if there are any topics you're still afraid to write about.
That's a good question. I'm not really, but there's something that's difficult to write about, of course, but no, it's not. I mean, I do write about what interests me, and it's not like, I'm interested in that, but I can't really write about it. So no, not really.
Alia says, it's a very high priority question to keep with one of favorite Paris Review interview questions of all time. What is your smoking status as of now?
Unfortunately, I'm still on the, what do you say, on the brink of quitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm still smoking.
Had you given up in the past?
I did. I stopped for 1 year completely and it was great. And then just one cigarette and then back on it.
And Edvard asks, we touched on this, in the first My Struggle, sitting at the airport, the protagonist reflects upon how the place one writes literature impacts the style of the writing. So as you wrote Morning Star in London, he asks, can you feel London in the text? Can the reader?
That I can't answer. I don't think so. No, it's very much me imagine my home country and kind of, and the difference between fiction and memory is not very big for me. Yeah. So it's kind of a making Norway that never have exist and kind of go in there and write.
Do you think it's easier to write about somewhere if you are not there?
Definitely. Definitely it is. That's why it's hard to write, for instance, about London. But the advantage is when you come here, you see things afresh, and that sticks with you, the way you see things. And so that's a way to enter it. But no, I don't think London is present in that novel, in any direct sense, I mean.
Okay. Now, Ben asks, is it difficult to go on, say, doing interviews, given what the public knows or thinks they know about your feelings about them? So you just touched on this, really, but are you aware of sort of what the public thinks of you when you're giving an interview? Or?
No. No, I'm not when I'm writing. Actually, I try to stay out. I don't read reviews. I don't read interviews. I completely stopped with that many years ago because it's like an invasion. And who is inviting you? Yeah, yourself. Mm. And that's not very healthy. And even when I, you know, meet people, I never think that they might know anything about me. I don't know how that's even possible, but I do. Mm. So it's kind of a constant denial of facts, yeah. And then it's fine.
Yeah.
But it's very important when it comes to writing not to think, for me, about how people will think or what they would expect or anything, because that's a restriction, and that's one part of making it less alive, I think.
Thank you. So now Adam asks, so you've described the Swedes as cyclopes. How would you describe the British, or do we have to wait and see? We have to wait for your book.
Oh, yeah, you have to wait and see.
So that was an essay, wasn't it?
It was an essay.
Swedes, they're sort of monovision, I guess, because you can tell us what you meant.
Yeah, well, that was the only kind of angry essay I've ever written, I think. That was that essay. It was a response to some to some views on what I've been doing. No, the thing was that there was, even when I came to Sweden, which was like 17, 18, 9, even 19 years ago, it was a sense of that there was something that you couldn't say. And if you said it, you were being ostracized.
Yeah.
And then it was like one thing, really, that you could say. And then there was something in the margins you couldn't. And if you were a writer, you lost... You didn't get any stipendiums. You know, it was like, what is this? And that's the figure with one eye is this. Mm-hmm. But that can change. It could be then. It could be that, and then it could be this. Mm-hmm. But it's a very different mentality. I know it's dangerous to generalize mm-hmm. wildly like this.
Yeah.
But in Norway, which is a very different society in that respect. That's just. It's not a major thing. It may exist, but it's not a major thing. So that's why I wrote. But every time I do an interview in Sweden, that's right. What I have to justify somehow.
Yeah.
But I never got so many letters ever as I did article. So that was very interesting too. It was like, but it was very... I think I could say it because I was Norwegian.
Mm.
Then you are kind of, well, he's Norwegian, and you know, it's. I'm not taking that seriously as I would if I was a Swede. It is an interesting thing with that kind of culture and nationality, and because it is, of course, incredibly complex.
Mm.
But what I was really relating to there was the sphere of newspapers. The cultural sphere, and that's not Sweden. That's a tiny part of it, you know.
When you say you got lots of letters, were they agreeing with you? Were they angry? Was it a mixture?
It was no angry letters. It was many Swedes abroad that probably had left the country who wrote about their experiences with this.
But I think, yes, as you say, it's a small part of Sweden, exactly. It's not the real, and it's a bit exactly. Like the culture wars here. You know, it's a small part,
exactly.
Of the UK, but yes. So there's nothing about the UK that's made you so angry so far that you've written an angry essay.
No, not really. Not really. It feels like here is possible to have several thoughts in the head at the same time, Much more, but that's, you know, it's. I was also very angry when I wrote it, and it has to be taken into consideration. I can't really sit here and do Swedish bashing because I don't feel like that. Yeah. I do like the comfort, too, you know.
Yeah. So we have a question here from Jesse. I'm wondering if in Morningstar there is any conscious influence from other books, possibly from high modernism, like Ulysses or Mrs. Dalloway, that represent many characters experiencing the same thing on the same day. Just any influences?
It was funny, but the great thing about Joyce is that everything takes place on the ground in the moment, and the arc of, you know, history or ideas or whatever is only seen through kind of glimpses and bits and pieces here and there. And it feels very, very real. And so the experimentation with forms and all kind of, goes into that. Mm-hmm. And Miss Dalloway is also very much the sense of a life in a day. Mm-hmm. That's more like that than in Joyce, because but still. And that has influenced not only this book, but the whole way of thinking about literature. Mm-hmm. What it is, and also what it is to be, and what the relationship we have with idealism or politics or aesthetics or whatever. It's present. It's not present in the moment. It is present, like, you know, bits and pieces. And you can get the impression that it is part of us, you know, that it is like actually like a movement, or that it all hangs together. But in the moment, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that was such an achievement in that period, from those two and several others also, to do that. And the way, you know, just the way Ulysses are present, or Dante is present, or, yeah, it's, but it, my writing doesn't look like it at all, but it's just the approach almost that I do relate to, I think.
I suppose every writer who's come after them has that influence in some ways.
Yeah, I think so. And then,
And I think you've talked about other influences, popular fiction on this book, Dracula, I think you said.
Yeah, Dracula has always been a huge favourite of mine since I read it as a very young person. And then I've read it basically through my life. And it's not that it's incredibly well written. It's not Joyce or Virginia Woolf, but it has something, it captures something that still intrigues me, really. And it is very suspenseful and all of that. And it crosses some boundaries that I'm interested in, which has to do with life and death. So nothing in this book looks like Dracula, but it is kind of, it's the same thing. It's the approach that's there.
Now, Katie asks, what is it like to read your book in English, and do you ever write in English?
Thank you for that question, because then I can do what I should have done at the very beginning, to mention that it's translated by Martin Aitken, and he has done a brilliant job. And the thing is, I never read translations normally, because I think the translator has to get it, the whole thing. And if he or she doesn't, then it doesn't help to change anything, or it's the feeling. But in this case, I asked to read it when he was halfway through, because there's so many characters, there's so many things that can go wrong. And I started to read it. And the thing is, to me, it was like reading it in Norwegian. It was like, just after a few minutes, I was kind of in it. And that's, I don't know how it's even is possible, because it's the tone that's present. Writing in English, I do write, you know, emails, but I could never write a book in English. No way. It's completely out of reach, and will be for all future and all. Because writing, to me, it's so subconscious. Can't think. And when I write English, I have to think, have to, you know, drag some word up or look in for words, and then I can't write.
Thank you. We have a question from Anonymous. Music always features prominently in your writing, and the characters in Morning Star listen to a wide variety of contemporary artists. Did you think a lot about what kind of music your characters would listen to, and what does it say about them? So, yes, we learn a lot about their musical tastes.
Yeah.
At least one musician as well, one of the characters.
Yeah, they're very kind questions, this. Yeah. Yeah, that was very important, actually. Having finished that book, I made a playlist for all of the characters. They're online. So you can actually go and listen to what they are playing. And it is, you know, I mentioned just I wanted a book like a choir, but I also wanted like music to kind of run through it somehow, at least for some characters. And one thing is that, you know, music is very joyful. It's one of the things that almost is pure joy. You listen to it, and it gives you something, lifts you up. And it's one of the things that you can talk with someone from that you don't know, from, you know, completely different part of the world. You could just mention some artists and you have a connection, you know. So that was, yeah, and it was fun. I mean, finding out what a 20-year-old girl would listen to, that was fun, and I listened to that music when I was writing, and it has a lot to do with identity, what you listen to, you know, and especially in that age, maybe.
And on the same theme, Kat asks, is music important to you as you write? Do certain albums or singers infiltrate into your work? And she also asks, does living in London have a certain soundtrack for you? So, know about that, but do you listen while you
write? I always listen to music, always done it, constantly. I can't, it's hard for me to write without music. And I do listen to often it's only one album for a book, maybe two or three, but it has to be repeated every day, the same songs, the same albums. That creates kind of a safe space, a familiar space, you know, so you could go in there and it is a familiar space, and then you can write however you are not far away from home, because it's you're surrounded by it. And so it's very much, like one novel is pure Iron and Wine, one novel is one lamp shop album, this one was very much Father John Misty.
Right.
There's a lot of American stuff, really. But I said British music in the beginning here. That's where I feel like I come from. It ended up in Americana, unfortunately.
Sorry, we forgive you. And Kat also asked, does anyone know where we can find the playlist? Maybe she.
Yeah, it's on call themorningstar.no. And you got a lot of artworks and photographies and lots of stuff there, which also was fun. It's made by the designer of the Norwegian book.
Great. And one last quick question from Anonymous. What's the best UK supermarket? Are you a Morrison's man? we know you spend a lot of time in supermarkets.
Yeah, well, I use the local supermarkets, and there's no choice really. It's Tesco and Sainsbury's.
Okay, right. No endorsement, just
no. Does this question mean something other than I thought? Maybe
not that I've got. Maybe it's just, you know, you spend such a lot of time queuing in supermarkets.
I'll be writing about it. So.
So you're a supermarket connoisseur, maybe behind it. But I think we've come to the end of our time. Sadly, but Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, anyone who likes your books will love this. But also, as you say, doing something different. It's really good. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for watching.
Yeah, and thank you very much.
Questions.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.